This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Bernie Sanders supporters wonder why Black Democrats are giving most of their votes to Hillary Clinton. An environmental scientist blasts the federal EPA for creating the climate in which Flint, Michigan's water was poisoned. And a Black political prisoner and poet passes after 45 years behind bars.
But first, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations will hold a national conference on the presidential elections and Black self-determination on April 9th in New York's Harlem. Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela says the electoral arena is only one aspect of politics and has historically been the least useful for Black people.
I think that our possibilities are always determined by our sense of organized collective power on the ground. I think it's important to remember that even what we call the right to vote was not won by voting. It wasn't won through the electoral process. It was won through organized resistance by our people on the ground in the form of the civil rights movement, the struggle for democracy that's, you know, been called the civil rights movement, and how it morphed into the whole Black Power movement. We saw the Black Panther thing. And when we saw this kind of phenomenon, you know, we were seeing people like Huey P. Newton and Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Seale and other forces like that running for political office. And they were running for political office as representative of a real organized capacity on the ground, if not an actual capacity to be elected. They were running off the basis of the fact that there was a strong sense in our community of the struggle for self-determination. There was no confusion about that. So, I mean, Malcolm X, the ballot of the bullet, there was a sense of self-determination. I think that's the element that has not been won yet. And I know that there was a conference that was held, I think, in January in Philadelphia with more than 1,000 people, I understand, who did say something about self-determination, but that demand for self-determination or movements that really define the objective as self-determination, that is to say the right of African people to have our own independent power, that is not something that has actually got the kind of mass traction that it needs in order for us to be able to respond in an effective way, the way that we need to be responding to this election. So the problem, it seems to me, even when we look at the elections and the electoral process, is for us to be projecting and always struggling for self-determination and not to give the people the assumption that a solution is there within the electoral process for us. Even if we say that we are participating in an election, I think it's absolutely clear to inform the people that this is some interim thing that we're doing in the process of moving forward toward real power. I think what we are seeing now with this election is real evidence of our own political weakness. And I say our weakness, I'm talking about of a revolutionary movement on the ground. And I think that's the thing that I've worked for all the time. And that's the reason I think that we have with the Black is Back Coalition is so important. That's why we say Black power matters. That's why we say a Black community control of the police. And we do things like struggle for Black people's grand jury. And we do things like introducing charging genocide. The assumption here is to try to move, create a whole new trajectory for the community. Because I think that what we are talking about and demanding are things that the Black community can unite with. I don't think there's any question about that. The problem is that most people who call themselves leaders do not unite with that and always, in my view, take the opportunistic stance saying that, well, that's good in the long run, we can win this later on, but right now we've got this big problem. And of course, the long run, the struggle for what we want in the long run, it's something that starts now. You don't start later to fight for what we're looking for in the long run. And so we're always playing catch up. We're always having to deal out of fear, out of certain kind of anxiety. Fascism is around the corner now. It was around the corner. If you remember when McCain was challenging Obama, fascism was around the corner. It's around the corner now with Donald Trump. And the thing is, what that always means to us is that usually a vote for a Democrat, some Democrat, or some other alternative that's a part of the system, as opposed to building our own power. And we do not concentrate on building our own independent capacity, our own independent power. And I think that's the problem that we're confronted with. And because even while people are talking about Donald Trump, and there's reason for people to be anxious about Donald Trump, but even if you talk about Donald Trump, you can't miss the fact that there's an overlap between the base of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. You're talking about lily white, enthusiastic white people, mobs of white people. I'm characterizing as mobs. I mean, you've got these tons of people coming out for Sanders, tons of people coming out for Trump. And even though Sanders calls himself a revolutionary or talks about a political revolution or talks about socialism, I heard Sarah Palin talking about Trump being a revolutionary and we need a revolutionist. This is the revolution. I think the problem is that when white people unleashed is the problem. In the absence of African people having our own capacity, and I don't mean having a capacity that we can contend with them in the election, but we have to have organized leadership, and we have to project leadership that itself can project an independent political power, independent political capacity for our people, and that's a missing element, and that's problematic.
Yes, in the general black political discussion, you don't hear talk about policy. That is, what should black folks be pushing in terms of policy on economics, policy on criminal justice, foreign policy? But instead, we hear which candidate should black folks be aligning themselves with?
Or what we hear is the kind of language that Obama and Sanders are capable of using, even Jesse Jackson has used, the whole notion that the rising tide lifts all boats. So when Sanders talks about $15 per hour over a number of years, which in my view is simply putting a cap on what the wages of people can be over a number of years, that should be satisfactory because black people need to make more money than what we make now. We're working in fast food joints and service industry, et cetera, and don't make enough money. But I think there's a problem that we always have to find ourselves being satisfied with the inability of any politician, any whether it's Hillary Clinton, Sanders, or any others of the white people who love us, to be able to speak directly about our interests when they can do it about everybody else's interests. And it's a real problem because if they say that they cannot get elected, if they say, look, the black community has suffered all of these things for a number of years and we have to speak to that, and they say, well, if we say that, then the white voters won't elect me, then what they're also saying is that we got a whole bunch of dangerous white people out there who are subject at any given day of turning on us, as we're looking now at the mobs who are coming out with Trump. So what's to stop them from coming out on any other circumstances? Nothing at all. And even when people talk to us about the fear of fascism, I still don't get that, because at the time when fascism was real in the world and the United States was involved in a war that was designed to stop fascism, it was the Democratic Party that was locking up Japanese in this country under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was the friend of the white left and that participated in even leading the Japanese into the damn concentration camps. But never has there been a discussion about fascism when the government is killing black people, shooting us down the streets. What the hell is that? How many black people have to get killed per week for it to be what they describe as this alarming, a new situation that seems to apply to white people when things get rough? I'm just disturbed by that, and I think it represents a real weakness on the part of our folk and an unwillingness to stand up for ourselves and to say that we can take an independent political position in our own interest. And the problem is that even when we talk about policy at this point, because there is no strong presence throughout this country demanding revolutionary transformation, it's not there in a strong presence. It's not something that has become a part of a common narrative, as it was during the era of the Panthers, as it was when there was a real Nation of Islam and Malcolm X was around, as it was, because remember, when we talk about the Panther era and we talk about the old Nation of Islam, those were just the better known forces out there. Throughout this country, African people were talking about revolutionary transformation, and that representing a real position of strength and power that does not exist today. So we can ask the white people, make these kinds of demands, if we would, and even that's weak for us, of the candidates, but we don't have any juice. And the reason we don't have any juice is because there's no recognized collective project trajectory for our community, which is why, again, I think it's been so important that the coalition has talked about Black Power Matters and Black community control of police, not because we think overnight that's going to happen, but that puts us in a whole other trajectory, and it challenges just open-ended, simple-minded things like Black Lives Matter that does not make an assumption of power in the hands of Black people that Black people ourselves obviously unite with. And we need to have a demonstrably united community around revolutionary demands coming from our community. And that's a serious weakness, because we don't, in general, make great demands, which is, again, one of the things that I've found to be really important about the coalition. One of the things I found important about April 9th, we get 100, 200 people there coming from various places around the country who talk about the 2016 election and the struggle for self-determination and the struggle for Black self-determination. That discussion is not being held otherwise. The coalition has been, right now there's a so-called peace movement that's willing to talk about stop the oppression against Black people, but they're not talking about Black power for Black people, for the Black community, etc. That's what the coalition, I think, is playing such a fundamentally important role, because it has entered into this discussion. It has struggled to change the narrative, and it has also struggled to help the African community unite in a trajectory that suggests and lead to the question of self-determination, Black self-determination. And it doesn't matter that everybody in the coalition does not necessarily agree to what the hell that self-determination means, because we didn't when we said Black power in the 60s. Everybody didn't agree with what it meant. But the thing is, when you say Black power, that changes the discussion, changes the narrative, and everybody has to deal with that question. And now that's the kind of trajectory I think we have to be on. So in terms of what kinds of demands, I mean, can we demand, are we willing to demand that the U.S. government free all the Black political prisoners, that the U.S. government, can we demand a reasonable projects that would result not only in an income, but an income that contributes to the development of our communities, right? I mean, say somebody making $15 an hour, which is like a $15 raise that we've got since slavery, right? Somebody gets $15 an hour. So what happens to that if we get it over a number of years, as Bernie Sanders is talking about? How does that contribute to the development of our community, as opposed to simply being money that's going to go right back to the people who gave it to us through one of the orifices that they have established for taking money from Black people and working people and oppressed people everywhere? I think that it would be important if we were able to develop a kind of national conference where we could have this discussion and develop a Black agenda for our community, a real Black agenda that we can agree on, and that starts from an important principle of self-determination. We have to have an independent political trajectory. We have to recognize the significance of having an independent Black politic, and that's not something that exists right now. And that's problematic to me, because right now the question is, which of these forces are we going to be throwing in with, whether it's going to be this sector of the Democratic Party versus that sector of the Democratic Party, whether it's going to be the Democratic Party versus Donald Trump. That's the place where we find ourselves now. And I truly believe with all my heart that the coalition offers a third way in calling on African people to look toward the issue of self-determination and continue this project of trying to define projects that we can unite around that contribute to self-determination, and to the extent that we win it with greater number of folk coming into it, even becoming more explicit about what self-determination means.
It seems to some of us that a likely scenario in this election is that Hillary Clinton wins the Democratic nomination. She goes on to beat Donald Trump. She puts together a large, big tent campaign that is in opposition to Donald Trump's racism. And when she wins, all the forces, including these black Democrats, declare a defeat of racism. But
yeah,
black folks would have made no demands in terms of what the society looks like, except it doesn't have Donald Trump as president.
I think that's right. And that's a profound weakness. And from my perspective, Brother Glenn, our problem is our lack of strength and power in our own communities, and the fact that there is not a real concerted effort to build independent black political base. And the problem is that we have movements that always responding simultaneously to events that happen in the world, whether it's a Barack Hussein Obama, which was a real problem, serious problem for us, or whether it's a Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, etc. We are dragged about by events without having established our own independent agenda that determines what our course is and then determines what our relationship with anybody else will be in the world in achieving the objectives that we establish for ourselves. Now, I'm saying this, and I know that right now we're in a place where an election is going to happen, regardless of the state, the level of organization that we've achieved in our community. This election is going to happen. And I don't think that our future will be determined by this election. I think that we have to continue doing the kind of painstaking work that we have committed to build a real movement, a broad-based movement for self-determination. And this is something that has eluded a lot of forces precisely because element of principle has been involved, precisely because the difficulty of struggling for independent black political power. The fact is that, as you know, when we first started trying to build the coalition, many people who we knew of in different periods have been involved as militants, as black Marxists, black nationalists, black progressives, black leftists, etc., could not participate because it meant engaging in independent black political activity, and they wanted to be connected to Barack Hussein Obama, which meant connected to the Democratic Party. So they couldn't leave the Democratic Party to come to their own community to build this base. But I think that a lot of that stuff is unraveling. And there's something that's happening today that I think we should be really conscious of. What is obvious is that when you see what's happening, like in the white community, and I say this around the electoral process, the thousands of people who are coming out for Trump, the thousands of people who are coming out for Sanders, and then, of course, there's the middle with the Clinton, what have you, but the fact is that Trump has such a following and Sanders have such a following is because the number of people who are absolutely dissatisfied with what's happening in the country and who've concluded, though they're not quite clear on this, that the state cannot resolve the contradictions for them. But guess what? Our community has said that much earlier than now. That's what all the mobilizations we've been looking at since August 9, 2014. That's what all those demonstrations about black people. That's why you can't go on the internet right now without hearing black people talking about blackness and Africa and trying to make some kind of fundamental transformation. There is something afoot here in the country, and I think we end up tailing masses of people when we just get trapped in this thing. We got to go for whether Democrats or Republicans, and that's where the future lies. And the future lies in organizing these millions of African people who are absolutely fed up, disgusted, and don't see a future in what is being offered by either political party or by America itself. And I think that what we have to do is achieve the audacity, to coin a phrase, to step beyond what appears to be the limitations, the political limitations that's offered us at this particular moment. I don't think that this election is going to determine our future. I am not afraid of it, and I think that this is a splendid time for us to go directly to the African community and push for a revolutionary program and bring people into a revolutionary organization. I mean, that's what I do all the time, and that's what I would like to see the coalition offer a path to by examining what is an election any damn way. I mean, They don't have elections to offer African people an opportunity to meet our objectives. They don't have elections because they think this is the way that the so-called Latinos and working people are going to be able to achieve our objectives. That's what the elections are set up for. And if we get anything out of the election, it's an accident. That, or it's because they've got enough power on the ground that forces the elections to take a different particular kind of shape and pushes it in the trajectory that our people are trying to go in. So the election is not the solution. The solution is black power. And black power is not something that's conferred upon us by wishing for it, et cetera. We have to organize for it, and we have to go into our communities, and we have to help to change the narrative, and which, again, is part of what I think the significance of the coalition is, to change the narrative, because it makes a difference. It's not innocent. There's just still Black Lives Matter. It makes a difference in the narrative and what the political line is. And I'm speaking here now broadly. I'm not even talking about sharp, definitive differences that can even exist among groups that can have the same general line. I recognize that. But certainly the whole notion of self-determination has to be the thing that drives the general broad movement that we're involved in. And that's what the coalition will help us to do. Black Community Control the Police. It's a broad-based kind of demand, one that people can unite with if we become more efficient and effective in taking it out. And of course, the media would rather have the bourgeois media, the white nationalist media, whether it's black white nationalist or white nationalist media, would prefer to define things simply as Black Lives Matter, any kind of activity dealing as Black Lives Matter, because it does not challenge the status quo at all. And the bourgeoisie is more afraid of Donald Trump than they are of a Black Lives Matter movement, because the Black Lives Matter doesn't offer a single challenge. It's a whining recognition that something naughty is happening to us and that we don't have the power to do anything about it.
And in fact, there would not be all of this talk and rhetoric coming from at least two wings of the Democratic Party if there had not been action in the street.
Exactly.
I remember about 2 years ago, the NAACP and the Urban League and various black civic organizations said that they were going to come up with something they called a black agenda, but nothing came of that.
And I think it would be difficult for them because the truth is that the NAACP is a wing of the Democratic Party. You know, you got labor unions that are quite militant. SEIU is one of them. I see it in action in various places around the country, coexisting, sometimes overlapping with Black Lives Matter kind of stuff. It's the left wing of the Democratic Party. And it's militantly a part of the left wing of the Democratic Party. So we see this kind of phenomenon. So when we look for a black agenda coming from them, it's not going to deal with the kinds of issues that will mobilize the majority of the people and take them into a trajectory that would challenge the status quo, that would make the status quo have to move in some way. That is something the NAACP is not going to do. Never has done. You can't even think of a time when the NAACP has done that within the last 50 years or more, if ever. So that's a real problem that we have. Independent black political activity, that's the thing. That's the missing ingredient that we are confronted with right now.
Minimally speaking, what would you like to see come out of this upcoming conference on April 9th?
Minimally, what I would like to see, we're going to have, I think, a lot of young people who will attend this conference, a lot of energetic people who will attend this conference. And I think that we will see a re-energizing of some of the working group, particularly the Black Community Control the Police project that's come from the coalition. We're going to see that out there. And I think that the discussions, Glenn, I mean, you're accustomed to these kinds of discussions all the time, but I really feel like we have really high-quality discussions that takes the question out of the abstract, the question of self-determination, and I think it lays it out there for a lot of people to be able to see and a lot of young people who are coming into political life to understand. And a lot of people who are not young but have been in political life, I think, will be able to benefit and have been benefiting from these events and conferences that the coalition has been having over the last several years. I think that we've been in the process of really establishing a real kind of political and ideological base. So minimally, I would like to see more forces come into the coalition. I would like to see us effectively begin to explain the elections. We're going to talk about the election. We're going to talk about Trump and talk about Sanders and Clinton and what that means. And I know that a lot of that you will be providing. But I also think that we need to, in the process of doing that, speak to the question of what the elections are. What is the electoral process? Because our community has come to the conclusion, subsequent to the Voting Rights Act, that there's something biblical about the elections, almost. That it's like in the Bible, thou shalt vote every 4 years to make sure that the right person is elected president or something to that effect. And I think that to explain what the electoral process is, there's an assumption that it's this thing that's been put there to offer just democracy for the people, etc., that the elections must be explained and understood, and more people have the ability to grapple with that. And then I think we have to talk about the specifics about this particular election, the Trump phenomenon, the Sanders phenomenon, and, of course, all of the players in here. I think we have to have some kind of discussion about that as well. I would like for people to leave the election unafraid, not feeling that these white people in either party can or should determine our future. And I would like for people to leave from this conference with a better understanding of what the electoral process is, why it's there, what it's for, et cetera, and what we should expect to get out of it and what we shouldn't expect to get out of it. And I would want people to leave the conference on April 9th understanding about the specific players involved in this election and what kind of relationships we have with them or should or shouldn't have with them. And then finally, I would like for people to leave there united with the various campaigns that the coalition has adopted and the campaigns around black community control of the police. I would like to see the ability of the coalition to unite with the stuff that's coming from the working group, an explanation of the Flint water poisoning of our communities and the demands that we can make now for reparations. Africans charge genocide and the significance of that as a demand that we're putting out. I mean, those are some of the things I would hope to come out of the conference on April 9th that we'll be doing right there in Harlem, New York. Malcolm X used to call it the capital of the black world.
And we would hope that folks leave that conference with an understanding that self-determination is not picking an item from an electoral menu that's chosen by other people.
Splendid. Exactly. In fact, that's an absolute necessity. And we do so much better when we develop our own agenda. And like I said, we didn't vote to get the right to vote. And we didn't get that by voting. We got that through organization. We didn't make any advances there. I can't think of a single advancement that Africans in this country have made through the electoral process. Malcolm, Panthers, black militants throughout this country, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, all of those forces working, Martin Luther King, our own agenda, and in almost every instance having to go against the political organization, having to fight Johnson, who the Democrat, having to fight Reagan, the Republican. All of these forces we had to fight all down the line, and we were not confused about the fact that it had to be our own power, our own agenda that set the terms for this relationship that we're going to have in this country with each other and with anybody else.
That was Omali Yeshe Taylor of the Black is Back Coalition.
Veteran activist and historian Paul Street last week published an article titled "Bernie, Black and Blue, Reflections on Race in the Democratic Primaries." This month, large numbers of black, brown, and white demonstrators, some of them Bernie Sanders supporters, went to a Donald Trump rally in Chicago and then shut it down. But Sanders was not pleased. Although the Vermont senator claims to want to start a political revolution, he doesn't like the idea of disruption.
Well, he was on, you know, one of these town halls. I love you. You know, they call these things town halls when they're organized by CNN. You know, it's a real organic, popular, community-based organization there, huh? But anyway, you've got your officially certified CNN town hall, and Jack Tapper, the CNN host, hits him with a denunciation of that Bernie got from Donald Trump, saying, you know, keep your people under control, keep your people under control. And he, Sanders is responding to that, and he's very clear. He says, first of all, I want to make it clear that Donald Trump is a pathological liar. And Bernie goes into a kind of an interesting spiel, and I thought he was kind of right, about isn't it absurd that Donald Trump wants to pick up the legal expenses of a racist thug who sucker punched a black guy at a recent Trump rally. And, you know, I thought that made some sense. And then he goes into this bit about our campaign doesn't support any structure of any kind. We don't want to break up any meetings. That's not what we're about. We're not about disruption. And, you know, I thought about that. And first of all, why on earth wouldn't young black and Latino and Muslim and female students at the University at Illinois at Chicago on the near west side of Chicago, which is largely black and Latino, why wouldn't they, after their many months of very creative and wonderful rank-and-file direct action against Rahm Emanuel and other forms of abuse in the Chicago area, why wouldn't they stop a rally, a giant rally being planned by and for a white nationalist, you know, an open, vicious, misogynist, sexist, a nativist, an anti-immigrant basher? Of course they disrupted that, and of course that's a legitimate part of American political life and has been for a very long time. I guess Bernie needs to go back and reread, if he hasn't read it before, Howard Zinn's best-selling classic history book, People's History of the United States. It's a story of disruption and of progressive change in activism and direct citizen militancy that goes back to and before Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, up through the Boston Tea Party in 1774, up through the first 10-hour, then there were 8-hour strikes in the 19th century, up through great abolitionist actions to prevent federal authorities from taking fugitive slaves out of northern cities, through the Underground Railroad, through the general strike that W.E.B. Du Bois talked about taking place on the slave plantations during the Civil War, to Denmark Vet. I mean, you know, I could go on all the way through the sit-down strikes and the rise of the New Left and the Black Power movements and the Civil Rights movements and the feminist movements have all depended on occupations, disrupting actions. I'm guessing yourself, I myself, have been involved numerous occasions in attempts to disrupt things. Better believe it. I remember being down in Washington, D.C. in 2000 to try and disrupt and interrupt meetings of the World Bank. These guys are sitting around plotting and working out new ways to impose austerity on and extract wealth from third world countries. Mario Savio gave a famous speech at the height of the free speech movement in Berkeley about the duty of, well, in his case, students in the university system to lay their bodies down and on the machine and make it come to a grinding stop when it's engaged in hideous things like providing research for the American military industrial complex and its crimes in Vietnam at the time. Dr. King, in a wonderful series of lectures that had to be broadcast into the United States by the Canadian National Radio System in 1967, made a very strong and passionate argument for the urgent necessity of direct action to what he called dislocate the functioning of a society that had become essentially criminal. So, you know, to hear Bernie Sanders say we don't want to disrupt anything, we don't want to interfere with any meetings and all that is sort of another nail in the coffin of the notion that he is some sort of left icon or left hero.
Yes, Bernie Sanders' socialism has always been under question, but his position against disruption makes one wonder if he wants to shake up the system at all.
Well, I mean, here you got a guy who calls himself a socialist, who is openly embraced at least twice now in the town halls, and he's given a couple of speeches to college audiences in which he talks about the need for the continued private ownership of the means of production. I mean, so he's picking an argument there not just with Eugene Debs or with Karl Marx. He's picking an argument with Webster's dictionary definition of what a socialist even is. It's just socialism is not a few Scandinavian welfare programs, you know. It's been interesting to me, less surprising than it is for some other people, that a candidate has been able to make a pretty good showing in the primaries who sort of stubbornly clings to this deceptive and false description of himself as a socialist. It's interesting to me that that hasn't sunk him. I mean, it's good that it hasn't sunk him. I find that intriguing, you know, and sort of reflective of the fact that the Cold War is as far away as it is now, and it's not as nasty a word as it is. And also a reflection on the fact that capitalism is just is an utter disaster, particularly for young Americans, well, for everybody, but particularly as it's experienced right now in the labor market by young folks, including even a lot of middle-class white kids who are graduating from college now with tens of thousands of dollars worth of you know, student debt and nowhere to go. So, I mean, it's interesting that he uses the word, but of course he doesn't mean it.
The group that most resembles Scandinavian social democrats is black people when we speak of economic issues. And yet black folks have flocked to Hillary in this primary season. How do Bernie Sanders supporters approach this failure of black people to support Bernie?
You know, I don't know if I said black people. I don't know if you said voters or people have flocked to Hillary. But if you look at the exit polling data, on all the primaries that we've had so far, three things just leap off of the charts. First one is the youth vote. Sanders is getting the youth vote because all these kids are having such a horrible experience with capitalism and they're desperate for something different, right? So it's really quite pronounced. These numbers are very high, the younger the voting segment is. The other thing that obviously leaps off is gender. Well, Hillary's getting more, about a 10% higher bump from female voters, which is not all surprising. But then the third thing that leaps off is the, at least among black folks that are participating in the primaries, is a pronounced tilt towards Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. And this really pisses off Bernie Sanders voters. And there's this kind of phenomenon now that I've been tracking and I overhear in person because I'm in a real sort of white middle class Bernie Sanders town. You want to see Bernie bros, you know, come to Iowa City or Madison, Wisconsin, or Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's campus town America. It's just kind of nuts what I'm saying. You get these sort of stereotypical ponytailed white Bernie bros, and I hear them in person, and I see them online, and I get some emails from them, too, because I've been very critical of Sanders from the left, and I get really angry emails from white Bernie Sanders guys. And it's funny, there's some of the same people who in 2007 and 2008 would lead you to believe that they were doing some great kind of liberal favor to black America because they were ready to vote for Barack Obama, who we, as you and I and others on the left said at the time, and yes, Obama has shown since, you know, is a very conservative, corporate, neoliberal, imperial, and by the way, objectively, white supremacist president, right, whose whole shtick and whose whole ability to win white voters was dependent on him distancing himself as much as he possibly could from racism as an issue deeply understood in America. So actually, some of these same guys who are so proud of themselves that they're ready to vote for Obama, now being very harshly critical of African Americans and almost like accusing them of stabbing Bernie Sanders in the back and not getting it, that Bernie Sanders was their man. And the thing that you hear a lot is, I just don't understand it. They see that if they voted for Bernie Sanders, that this would be the way to go. Well, I don't think the blacks have stopped being the leftmost section of the electorate for what that's worth, but I think the calculations are very different. I don't think there's any particular reason for Sanders supporters to think that his name would be well-known in black America. My sense is that a lot of African Americans, and I've had some conversations with folks about this, are pretty cynical, I think properly cynical, about the American electoral, American political and party system, and basically have a kind of defensive attitude towards the candidates, and basically would like to have the candidate that they perceive as most dangerous to black Americans as being defeated. And for better or worse, the candidate appears to be most dangerous, and it's not surprising. I don't think it's stupid. I think it makes a certain amount of sense. Would be Donald Trump. I mean, after all, he's got KKK people around his rallies, white nationalists. He talks in sort of openly, explicitly racist terms. I think a lot of black voters are like, you know, that could make things even worse, and are going to look at these two candidates, Sanders and Clinton, and go, well, this guy ain't going to win. This one is more likely to be able to block Donald Trump. And besides which, there's this kind of assumption on some of the white complaining Bernie bro guys. There's this kind of assumption that Bernie has made some particularly grand or great pitch for the black vote, that he's really tried to connect with black issues in a way that would be compelling enough to sort of pull black voters out of this kind of defensive, lesser evil mindset and vote for him. And I don't think he's really done that remotely or at all, really.
Yeah, it seems that these Bernie voters feel betrayed by blacks who don't support their guy without any understanding of how blacks historically may have feel betrayed by white liberals in the past.
Well, you know, Bernie's given he's given two full-on college addresses teasing out his incredibly diluted Scandinavian, which is very white, by the way, version of socialism. And he hasn't dedicated a single full address, as far as I know, to demonstrate his understanding of what the racial component of capitalism is, or what black experience is, or how he understands racism in any kind of deep kind of way in American society. And so there's this kind of underlying, supposedly self-evident assumption that a kind of European social democracy type of Keynesian economic policy will redound of black Americans, as well as this broad middle class that Sanders is always speaking in the name of. But interesting, isn't it, the choice of the term middle class instead of working class? I swear, you hear the phrase working class now more from Republican candidates than you hear it from Democratic candidates, even from a Democratic candidate who describes himself as a Democratic socialist. And history is not particularly kind to this narrative that let's just have New Deal social democratic programs and then racial inequalities will dissipate. And in fact, in the sort of leftmost, most social democratic era of American social policy from the late 1930s up through the 1970s, there's a wonderful book about this by a New York City scientist named Ira Katz Nelson. It's titled When Affirmative Action Was White. And he shows how actually during that height of the New Deal era, and really Bernie Sanders is sort of a modern-day New Deal liberal, where we had the Social Security Act and the Wagner Act, which legalized union organizing in this country, and then later we had the GI Bill, which opened up all kinds of doors for mostly for white veterans. So at the height of those programs, at the same time that millions and millions of white immigrant, working-class, lower-class people were being brought up largely through those programs into Bernie's middle class, racial inequalities actually deepened in this country and got worse, which is part of the context for the riots that broke out in the mid and late 1960s in this country. So history is not particularly kind to that notion that if you just kind of play it cool and keep quiet about race and just get on board with a social democratic program, that the racial inequalities are going to fall.
Paul Street's latest book is titled They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy.
One of those who testified last week at congressional hearings on the poisoning of Flint, Michigan's water supply was Professor Mark Edwards of Virginia Tech University. Edwards slammed the Federal Environmental Protection Agency for creating the climate in which the Flint poisoning occurred. He has these other choice words for the leadership of the EPA.
Willful blindness, in this case, to the pain and suffering of Flint residents. Unremorseful for their role in causing this man-made disaster. And completely unrepentant and unable to learn from their mistakes. Ms. Hedman said EPA had nothing to do with creating Flint. EPA had everything to do with creating Flint. Malfeasance at the US EPA from 2001 to the present has harmed cities all over the United States. And incredibly, even as National Guard walked the streets of Flint, distributing bottled water and installing filters on taps, Michigan and the EPA are able to say that Flint has never failed the lead and copper rule. And this is possible because the EPA has effectively condoned cheating on the lead and copper rule monitoring since 2006. This is because EPA and other agencies caused a similar lead and water crisis in Washington, D.C. from 2001 to 2004 that actually was 20 to 30 times worse in terms of the health harm to children in Washington, D.C. And they completely covered that up for 6 years and wrote falsified scientific reports. And it created a climate in which anything goes across the United States, anything at all, to cover up health harm from lead in drinking water. Since 2006, when we realized that this cheating was occurring, I worked with a small group of people who tried to expose these practices to EPA, and we failed. We failed to get EPA to take lead in water risks seriously. And because we failed, I was not surprised when Flint occurred. I was expecting a Flint to occur. If a landlord were to engage in similar practices and through their negligence to allow even a single child to be exposed to lead paint risk, the EPA would argue for prosecution and incarceration. Yet EPA has allowed entire cities to be unnecessarily exposed to elevated lead in their drinking water. And they've covered up evidence of their unethical actions by authoring these falsified scientific reports. And they never apologized for what they did in Washington, D.C. And incredibly, to this day, they have not apologized for what they did in Flint, Michigan. No apology from EPA. Completely unrepentant and unable to learn from their mistakes. I guess being a government agency means you never have to say you're sorry. And yesterday, I have to say, I was dumbfounded to read an op-ed by EPA Administrator Gina McCarty that effectively absolved EPA of any wrongdoing or any role in creating the Flint disaster. Aside from creating this climate in which a Flint was allowed to occur, I purposely observed, witnessed, and uncovered wrongdoing by Ms. Susan Hedman at the US EPA in covering up this problem. Ms. Hedman, at every step, aided, abetted, and emboldened the unethical behavior of civil servants at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. She allowed Flint's children to be harmed. And why should she not suffer the same or a worse fate than a common landlord who does the same thing? Had Flint residents not fought for the truth with the assistance of compassionate outsiders, it's incredible. The harm to Flint's children never would have been exposed. And so to quote Ms. McCarty's closing op-ed statement, I do agree with her. It's tragic it took a disaster of this sort to get this issue the attention it deserves. Let's do something about it. Ms. McCarty, you could start by acknowledging EPA's failures over the last decade to enforce the provisions of the EPA lead and copper rule. This is a critical and necessary first step to make EPA once again worthy and deserving of the public trust and its noble mission. Thank you.
That was Professor Mark Edwards testifying at congressional hearings on Flint, Michigan's water disaster.
Political prisoner Mondo Waylanga from Omaha, Nebraska, died in his cell at the Nebraska State Penitentiary this month at the age of 68. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, mourns the passing of a fighter and a poet.
He was born David Rice, and in his youth he joined an offshoot of the Black Panther Party, a decision that would change his life's trajectory. For when he and another young man, Edward Poindexter, joined the National Committee to Combat Fascism, they walked into the crosshairs of the state. The two men became enmeshed in a COINTELPRO scheme to remove them from the streets of Lincoln, Nebraska. Rice and Ed were charged with the August 1970 killing of an Omaha cop who picked up a briefcase loaded with dynamite. According to the group Nebraskans for Justice, another man, Christopher Peek, was the state's only suspect in the bombing. But shortly thereafter, after first exonerating Rice and Poindexter, Peek would become the state's chief witness against them. In April 1971, both men were convicted and given life terms. Such flimsy evidence would be a factor in Amnesty International naming the two Panthers as prisoners of conscience. On Sunday, we learned that Rice, who had changed his name to Mondo Welanga, died a lonely death in his prison cell after many years in a cage. Mondo and Ed were members of the National Committee to Combat Fascism, but in truth, they were Panthers, for that is certainly how the state treated them. Mondo Welanga and Ed Poindexter were servants of the people, dedicated to their freedom and dignity. Mondo Welanga and Ed Poindexter were soldiers for the people, dedicated to their defense and security. Mondo Welanga is no more. Neither is David Rice. And yet Mondo will be remembered for many long years for his service. Mondo, after many, many years in a cage, now joins his ancestors.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal. Last year, Mondo Welanga recorded one of his poems for prison radio. Its title, When It Gets to This Point.
Michael Brown, I had never heard of him. Had never heard of anything he'd done before the news of his death came. Whoever he might have become, whatever he might have achieved had he lived longer, not been riddled lifeless by bullets from Darren Wilson's gun, and crumpled on the pavement of a Ferguson street for more than 4 hours in the heat of that August day. And before, I'd never heard of Trayvon Martin, had known nothing of who he was until I learned of his demise and cause of death, a bullet to the chest. George Zimmerman, the shooter, a badgeless pretend police with a pistol and fear of the darkness, Trayvon's darkness. And after a while, the pictures, the names, the circumstances run together like so much colored laundry in the wash that bleeds on whites. Was it Eric Garner or Tamir Rice, who was 12 but seen as 20? Hulk Hogan or the Hulk, with demonic eyes, it was said, who shrank the cop in Ferguson into a 5-year-old who had to shoot, just had to shoot. And John Crawford, the third, in a Walmart store aisle, an air rifle in his hands, he picked up from the shelf and held in the open, in an open carry state. Was it John or someone else? Killed supposedly by mistake in a dark stairwell. I know Akai Gurley fell. I hadn't heard of him before, nor of Amadou Diallo or Sean Bell prior to their killings. Which of these two took slugs in the greater number? I don't recall. My mind is too encumbered with the names of so many more before and since. The frequent news reports of non-arrests, non-indictments, non-true bills, and duplicitous presentations by experts in the field, the consultants put out front to explain away that which is so often plain as day, to coax and convince us that we're the ones who can't see straight and can't hear clearly, who are the ones replacing facts with spin to mislead and mystify, as the beatings and the chokings and the shootings of our boys and men by these wrong arms of the law proceed in orderly fashion before the sometimes sad, sometimes angry faces of our uncertain, our hesitant disbelief.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.